Thanks for coming out tonight. Hopefully this lesson will be beneficial for everybody. If you were to ask just a random person if the Bible was real, if they're answering the question correctly, they would say yes, that most likely they say it's some sort of book, that it was written by somebody. But that's probably the most you could get anyone to agree on. But if you went as far to say as, well, do you believe in the Bible, you're going to get a big, pretty large amount of answers, right? And a lot of those answers are going to be that they don't. And what a lot of that comes down to is they simply just don't believe that the Bible is authentic, right? They might think it's a hoax or someone made it up, something like that. So tonight we would like to talk about the authenticity of the Bible. We'd like to talk about that the Bible is authentic, that it's genuine, that it's legitimate, that it's something that we can logically discuss and prove that it is real. And we also like to talk about that it's credible. It's something that we can believe in. So obviously this should have a pretty good application to us as Christians, right? If the Bible isn't authentic, then what's the point? So this should hopefully be uplifting to us that this shows that the Bible is authentic. And also one of the main points of this will be also to come up with a general idea or a outline in showing how to go about discussing that the Bible is authentic. You know, what are the main points that we could get across to someone to show that the Bible is authentic? So as we begin here, where do we even begin? So if you were to get in a conversation with someone or you're just trying to come up with your own way, where would you even start? So for me, I like to think of it in terms of a real world example. So if you think of an interview, if you were to apply for a job or your employer trying to look for someone, someone typically submits a resume, right? You see that resume and it looks legitimate, so you decide to bring that person in for an interview. And one of the main things that you do in an interview is ask a lot of questions, right? So you ask all these questions of this person, and they hopefully have answers. And by them coming up with all these answers, and they show their knowledge. So the idea here is that the person is showing their knowledge to help lend credibility to what they have to say and show that their resume that they submitted was legitimate and that they are a legitimate person. So likewise with the Bible has knowledge. We can use that biblical knowledge to help show that the Bible is authentic, that it has some credibility to it. The first way that it shows that it is that has knowledge is in kind of an odd way if you think about it, but it's circumcision. So in Genesis 17, verse 10, it says, "This is my covenant, which you shall keep between me and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised." So you're probably wondering where I'm going with this, or many of you might already know where I'm going with this. But the first thing about this is that God established this with Abraham as part of a covenant. And as one part of this covenant, he is promising Abraham a great nation. And he goes into detail about that in Genesis 12 and in chapter 13 and 17. And specifically in Genesis 13:16, he goes in as far as describing how numerous this nation would be. And he says in chapter 13:16 that, "I will make you descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if a man could number the dust of the earth, then your descendants could also be numbered." So a huge, huge nation. Well, we know from modern day medicine and the American Association of Pediatrics that, keep it generally PG here though, that circumcision just keeps helps reduce disease and infection in males. And what better way to make your nation great and prosperous is to basically reduce disease in your nation, right? If you're going to make this great nation as big as or as numerous as the dust of the earth, this is one way to do it from a very practical sense. And the Bible records this probably somewhere around 1500 BC, way before we knew any of the possible benefits of this type of thing. On top of that, it says in Genesis 17 and verse 12, "He who is 8 days among you shall be circumcised," which also seems like a very simple thing and probably from an average person's standpoint, it seems kind of random. But from modern medicine, also, we know that on the eighth day is when our bodies have the highest concentration of a certain blood clotting agent called prothrombin, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. So if you were to do some sort of minor surgical procedure, the eighth day is the day to do it. It's probably the safest time to do it for you. So the idea here is, in one way, is the Bible shows some sort of biblical knowledge about things way before modern medicine that gives it some credence, that gives it some legitimacy about what it knows. Another quick example, too, is in its cleanliness practices. So in Leviticus, we go through God sets aside all sorts of different cleanliness practices that that are very specific and kind of ahead of their time. So in Leviticus 15, it talks about different types of discharges, and the gist of this is in Leviticus 15, 11, and 13, where it talks about using running water to do washing. So in Leviticus 15 and 11, it says, "And whomever the one has discharged touch has not rinsed his hands in water, he shall wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean till evening. The vessel of the earth that he who has discharged touch shall be broken, and every vessel of wood shall be rinsed in water. And when he who has a discharge is cleansed of the discharge, he shall count for himself 7 days of cleansing, wash his hands, and bathe his body in running water." So many of the practices of other times would be like more of a stagnant bowl of water, which wouldn't be as useful. I mean, we see modern day, whenever the CDC or someone says to wash your hands, it's always with running water and soap. And furthermore, we also see in Leviticus 13 that we see all these very specific details about how to deal with leprosy and how to quarantine people. And this idea is lost on much of the rest of the world until the 1300s during the plague. They just now figured out, almost 3,000 years later, that, hey, maybe we should quarantine people that are sick, that are, have this really bad plague. But the Bible has done that from almost the beginning. So these are just some simple ways that the Bible shows knowledge that it potentially shouldn't have had known, which gives it some credence, gives it some legitimacy to show that it's from a higher source than just people making it up, right? So what's another way that we can show that the Bible the Bible is authentic? Well, if we go back to the idea of a interview, the last interview that I had to go through, it took almost a day to get through the interview. So they had probably 7 different people that interviewed me. It took place over several hours. They had all sorts of different questions, some of them the same, some of them different. And the whole idea behind that is still to keep that knowledge, to see if you have knowledge, but to see if you're making it up, right? If you're making something up, it's going to be a lot harder to make it up for 7 hours with a bunch of different people asking you a bunch of different questions. So it helps show your consistency throughout that interview process. Another example of that, if you've applied to a job online, sometimes they make you do those behavioral tests that they make you take like 100 different questions, and they're just slightly different. And it's the same idea, to see if you're consistent and seeing if you're trying to kind of make it up as you go. So just like with an interview, and that consistency helps show that person is legitimate, the Bible has consistency as well, and that will show its legitimacy as well. The most obvious way that we could show biblical consistency is by literally going through the Bible and showing that every verse doesn't contradict any other verse. Well, the problem with that is that's also the most labor-intensive. We couldn't sit here, I mean, we technically could sit here all night, but it would take us a very long time to go through every verse. It wouldn't just take us a night. So that's kind of like a take-home project for us, is as we study the Bible, that we're constantly seeing that and checking these supposed inconsistencies and making sure that the Bible is consistent. But there are some other ways that we can show biblical consistency that's not just through very pedantically going through each verse. And that one of those ways is through themes and prophecy. So the themes and the prophecies carried out in the Bible help show this constant stream of consistency from the very beginning of the Bible all the way through the Bible to the very end in the New Testament. Some of you may have studied types and antitypes before. Those are some of the examples that we'll go over real quick. They do a really good job of showing that as well. And mainly we'll stick kind of to the theme of salvation. The first example is the Passover lamb. It was a foreshadowing or a type of Christ. We see it happen or instituted in Exodus chapter 12, and we're not going to go and read through everything that happened there. We're just going to do the Cliff Notes version here. But the general idea is they had to sacrifice this perfect lamb and then spread its blood over their mantle, and then they had to go through a specific process on how to cook that, and that essentially saved their firstborn during the Passover. And then we can see this theme being carried over throughout the entire Bible and kind of ending up in the New Testament with Christ. And we see that Christ is our Passover lamb. So this theme is carried over. We can see in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 7 that it says, "Therefore purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us." And also in 1 Peter 1 and 19, it also says, "With the precious blood of Christ, as a lamb without blemish and without spot." So they're using the same terminology as this Passover lamb that was this lamb without blemish and without spot. So Christ, just like this Passover lamb, is our salvation, spiritually than the physical one in the Old Testament. Another theme that also carries over, keeping with these types of Christ, is Moses was a type of Christ as well. So this theme continues. Moses, we see in Exodus 3 and verse 10 that when he's speaking of the burning bush, that he was sent by God to save God's people, the Israelites. And then later we see when we can see the whole thing happen in Exodus, but actually Stephen has a pretty good summation of it in Acts 7 when he's speaking to the Jewish leaders. He says in Acts 7 and verse 35, when he's speaking specifically of how Moses was rejected by his people, yet he still was able to lead them out of Egypt. It says in verse 35 that this Moses whom they rejected, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge?" is the one God sent to be a ruler and a deliverer by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the bush. And he brought them out after he had shown wonders and signs in the land of Egypt and in the Red Sea and the wilderness for 40 years. So we see this Moses who is able to, he's rejected by his people, but able to save them. And then we see this kind of culmination in the New Testament of how Christ essentially did the same thing spiritually for us. And Stephen continues on that note later in Acts chapter 7, where he says in verse 51, that "you stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears, you always resist the Holy Spirit, as your fathers did, so do you. Which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who foretold the coming of the Just One, of whom you now have become betrayers and murderers." So these Jewish leaders straight up betrayed Jesus and crucified him. Yet Jesus was still able to save us on the cross through his resurrection. So we see this consistency throughout the Bible of it foretelling of Christ and showing these types of Christ from the very beginning and yet fulfilling it in the end. When these books were written over a period of approximately 1,500 years and by 40 or some known different authors, and they were able to keep this consistency, you know, that seems a lot more complex than a simple hoax. Some other really quick examples, for the sake of time, is baptism was also there was a theme throughout the Bible. We see this in the flood during or in Noah's Ark in the flood in Genesis, and this is referred to in 1 Peter chapter 3. This whole theme here, and we can go to 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 20, where it says, "Whom formerly were disobedient once." The divine long-suffering waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight souls, were saved through water. There is also an antitype, which now saves us, baptism. Not the removal of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This idea that when God knew what's going to happen, right, in the whole course of events, he knew that Noah's ark would be a good foreshadowing of baptism to come. And one more example is the Red Sea crossing. So we kind of go back to Moses here. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 in verse 1, it goes over this as well, referring back to there, where it says, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all baptized into Moses in the cloud and the sea." So this idea that Moses was also a type of Christ, and he also led the Israelites through a type of baptism. And so it's really interesting to see how God was able to keep these themes throughout the Bible, and it shows that this Bible is consistent. And just one more quick, I'm not going to go super in depth into prophecy, but prophecy also helps show that the Bible is consistent in a similar way. So the ones I wrote up there were just simply about Jesus, the very first prophecy of Jesus in Genesis chapter 3. And then we can see in Acts chapter 2, when Peter's speaking to the Jews on the day of Pentecost, he refers to two prophecies of Jesus. And the interesting thing about the prophecies, it's the same sort of idea as the themes with maybe types and antitypes, in that these things were prophesied and written down as early as Genesis, which was potentially written somewhere around 1500 BC, and these prophecies were seen fulfilled sometime after Christ, well, during Christ's death, and then, but as far as recorded and written down after Christ's death. And so, you know, it's not just pure happenstance that these things were fulfilled. It shows this perfect consistency that man can't simply make up. So we've hopefully shown some knowledge of the Bible, and we've shown some consistency in the Bible. So these are just some, you know, general examples that you can look at, and you can obviously come up with more ideas as well. But there's more that we can look at as well, another vein that we can look into. And that's, if you go back to the example of a interview, when you're doing this interview and you went through asking this person all sorts of different questions, and you question them for hours on end, and you're finally done, and maybe people get together and they kind of decide, well, do we want to hire this guy or not? Maybe someone's like, well, this guy could be a really good salesman or a con artist, right? He somehow made up things as he went. He's really good at that. So how do we know he's not making this up, right? So we can make that case of the Bible. How do we know all this stuff isn't completely made up? Well, just like with an interview, right, the person doing the interview can look at external resources, right? They can look at external resources to back up to see if that person is legitimate. They can look at something like where they went to school. Hopefully they said that on their resume. They can check into that school, make sure that degree is accredited, and for the specific major that would be helpful for that job. They can look at references. Maybe someone at the workplace referred that person specifically. And if you're sometimes nowadays they look at Facebook too to see if there's any red flags on that. And if you're going to apply to maybe a state job or in schooling, you would have to get a background check or something like that. So there's all sorts of external references that you can use to prove that person is legitimate, right? So there's a similar situation with the Bible. We can show historical references or secular references that line up with the Bible and help prove that these events that happened in the Bible weren't just stories that they made up, that there are external references that help collaborate those events. So the first one that we'll talk about, which I picked because it's kind of just interesting, was the Meshastili or Moabite stone. So this is actually sitting in the Louvre in France right now. And this is some writing by the King Mesha of Moab during the time of 2 Kings chapter 3. And in this, he's basically, in general, it seems like he's kind of bragging, but he keeps some sort of general facts in there, and it something to keep note when we're talking about these historical references is that these things, you know, have their own bias, right? They're coming from a specific historical source, so you have to keep that in mind when you're looking at these things. So just a quick excerpt from that. It says that Omri was the king of Israel and oppressed Moab during many days, and Chemosh was their supposed god, was angry with his aggressions. His son succeeded him, and he also said, I will oppress Moab. And then later on it goes in and it talks about, this is only a piece of it, but it goes in and talks about how supposedly Mesha had these great victories against the Israelites. And, well, it turns out that a lot of this stuff actually jives really well with what the Bible has to say. If we look into 1 Kings in chapter 16, we see that Omri did, in fact, reign in Israel. And we see that Omri had a son, eventually Ahab, who took over. And then in 2 Kings chapter 3, we see that Jehoram took over after Ahab. And in 2 Kings chapter 3 and verse 4, it says, "Now Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder," so the same guy, "and he regularly paid the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and the wool of 100,000 rams. But it happened, when Ahab died, that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel." So this is good. This shows that this historical reference, what Mesha said, is directly coinciding with what the Bible is saying. Ahab died. If we go back a slide, we see that the son, who is Ahab, also oppressed Moab. So then once Jehoram took over, Mesha decided to rebel. And we can see that in 2 Kings 3 that the Israelites tried to lead a campaign against the Moabites. And then finally we see the culmination of it in 2 Kings chapter 3 and verse 26. "And when the king of Moab saw that the battle was too fierce for him, he took with him 700 men who drew swords to break through the king of Edom, but they could not. Then he took his eldest son, who would have reigned in his place, and offered him as a burnt offering upon the wall, and there was great indignation against Israel, so they departed from him and returned to their own land." So this idea is that, you know, the Moabites were a vassal, essentially, of the Israelites. They rebelled against the Israelites. The Israelites led a campaign, and then they eventually were stopped because of this great show of desperation against them, and they backed off. And so in Mesha's eyes, right, he won, right? He's no longer a vassal of Israel at this point. So what's really interesting is this is a historical reference that is completely secular, the Mesha's deal, that directly coincides with what the Bible says. So this idea that this biblical account isn't just something that was made up. There's other sources saying that it was legitimate. Another example of this is maybe more personal to us is with Jesus. We read the Bible, right, and we see that Jesus is in the Bible and that he's our Savior, right? But, you know, sometimes people just look at that and say, well, we have to believe that because the Bible says so. And in a way, that's true. But there are also historical references that back up that this Jesus was an actual person that existed. The first one is there are some Roman records of this. There's a Roman historian, Tacitus, and in this specific excerpt, he's talking about these fires in Rome, and Nero's in charge at the time. And so when he's writing, he says, "Consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus, from whom the name had its origins, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate." So this whole idea that this is really cool because we see all this stuff happen, right, in the Bible, and sometimes we have those blinders on and only looking at the Bible, but then external sources say, yeah, this Tacitus guy, he's this historian, he's doing his job recording what's happening in these Roman times, and he's kind of just... It's almost like a side note. He's giving some background information on these Christians, and he's saying, oh, by the way, these Christians follow this guy, Christ, who was put to death by Pontius Pilate some time ago. But that's really big for us because it directly coincides with what we see in the New Testament, which lends some credence to Jesus, his existence. Another one, and once again, we go back to the whole idea of bias. So, you know, this one's written from the Jewish perspective, so we have to keep that in mind when reading it. But it still conveys that idea that Christ existed. And it just says briefly, the beginning of it says, "On Passover Eve, they hung the corpse of Jesus, the Nazarene, after they killed him by way of stoning." And if you kind of skip down towards the end, it says, "And the court did not find reason to acquit him, and so they stoned him and hung him on Passover Eve." So obviously there's a little bit of discrepancies coming from the secular source, but the general idea is that the Jews even, you know, confirm that there's this Jesus that existed. he was from Nazareth, and we killed him. And that just lends more credence to the fact that Jesus was a real person that existed, and the Bible is just not making this guy up, right? The last example we have of a historical reference is a little different in that it wasn't directly recorded in the Bible, but it was predicted in the Bible. In Matthew chapter 24 and verses 1, Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 24 and verse 1, "Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came up to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, 'Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down.'" And so he's predicting that the temple is going to be destroyed. But at the time, it was never recorded in any of the biblical or any in the Bible that it was destroyed. But we can see through history that it eventually was. So a Jewish historian, Josephus, documents this in the War of the Jews in Book 7. So he's documenting this Roman sacking of Jerusalem that happened about 40 years after Christ was crucified. And it says, "Now as soon as the army had no more people to slay or to plunder, because there remained no one to be the objects of their fury, for they would not have spared any had there remained any other such work to be done, Caesar gave the orders that they should now demolish the entire city and temple, but should leave as many of the towers standing as were the greatest eminency. But for all the rest of the wall, it was so thoroughly laid even with the ground by those that dug it up to the foundation that there was left nothing to be to make those that came thither believe that it had ever been inhabited. This was the end which Jerusalem came to by the madness of those that were for innovations, a city otherwise of great magnificence and of mighty fame among all mankind." So we see here that Josephus is recording that the Romans came in, they leveled it, they kept, I think it was three towers up, just basically for bragging rights, to say we took Jerusalem and it had towers that were this big, and they left a small garrison, like a few pieces of wall open for a garrison. But as far as the temple is concerned, as Jesus predicted, it's gone. And we can see that today, right? If you go to Jerusalem now, it's the Dome of the Rocks there, right? So whenever it was fulfilled, Jesus' specific prophecy, we can see that it eventually happened. There, we can go travel to Jerusalem or see pictures of it, and it's not there anymore. So hopefully through all of this, we've been able to see some examples. We've been able to see some examples that of the knowledge of God, of the knowledge of the Bible that has shown, lend some credence to its authenticity. We've been able to see some of the consistency in the Bible, that this consistency helps show that the Bible is authentic, that it's not something that's just made up. On that note, I remember when I was in college and trying to do a paper, and we had to do it as a group paper. We have all the technology that we have now, right? We live in the same period of time. We have phones, we have email, we have all this stuff, and we're trying to write a paper that was for or against some subject, and we couldn't even get that straight. Like, half of us were writing the paper for the subject, and the other half was writing against. Well, imagine if that was the Bible, right? If this wasn't inspired by God, it would be so riddled with holes and confusion that it wouldn't have this consistency. And then finally, hopefully we've shown that there are secular and historical references that help prove and show that what other people would maybe consider stories are actually real events that happened, and these people were real. So hopefully you guys, if you happen to, run into someone and you're trying to figure out, how to go about this, just show that the Bible has knowledge, the Bible's completely consistent, and there are historical references that back up the Bible. And if you can prove those three things, you can generally prove that the Bible is authentic. So hopefully, if you guys are out there tonight, hopefully most of you already know the Bible is legitimate, and this has helped reinforce it or helped give you some ammunition to discuss it with other people. If you didn't believe that the Bible was legitimate, but maybe now you're convinced, we talked about kind of in the middle of a section where this theme of salvation is throughout the entire Bible, and that's it culminated with Christ, and our salvation is through Him and through baptism through Him. If you need that tonight, we can help you with that. If you're still on the fence about it, if you need help with maybe studying more of the Bible, you're not quite ready for that baptism step, but we can also help you with that too. You can speak with any one of us here, and we'd be glad to help you. If anyone has obeyed the gospel but are struggling a little bit, we can offer prayers for you. If anyone has any spiritual need at this time, please come forward as we stand and sing.